Excellent. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our weekly Course in Miracles study group. And as always, I'm so thrilled that you all are here. Before we dive into our reading, let's begin with a brief period of meditation. So if you are able, allowing your eyes to close, and disconnecting for just a few minutes from the outer world and turning to the world within. Thoughts might be there that seem distracting or sticky, like our attention just wants to go to them, but just joining in with our collective willingness to drop our attention deep into the center of our being. This place deep within where we are connected with the Holy Spirit, always. It's this place within where we rest. It's this place within where we receive guidance on the busy doings on which we are sent, as the Course says. And just connecting with your willingness to loose the world from all you thought it was, to turn everything over to the Holy Spirit, knowing that that's how it's kept safe, for the ego can't misuse it when we give it to the Holy Spirit. And just taking a few deep breaths as you just imagine yourself relaxing into the Holy Spirit's arms. This holy instant we give to you. Be you in charge, for we would follow you. Certain that your direction gives us peace. If we need a word, a thought, or a tranquil open mind, these are the gifts that Holy Spirit gives, and we gladly place Holy Spirit in charge tonight by our request. And taking a nice, mindful, deep breath in and out. Even though we're not these bodies, we seem to be in them. And so it can be so helpful to ground and to center through some deep breaths. And coming together to our perception of right here, right now. Allowing your eyes to open. Welcome everyone, and welcome everyone who's joined us. I see you all on the phone and here on Zoom, even if your video is off. Glad you're here. So we're reading Cameo 15 on Edgar Cayce. It's page 1778 in the CE edition. I have a personal connection to this Cameo because the Association for Research and Enlightenment, otherwise known as the ARE, is an organization that was started by Cayce. They are located in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And not this past summer, but the two prior summers, I taught a week-long workshop for two consecutive summers at their summer camp in rural Retreat, Virginia. So a different location in Virginia. And it's just gorgeous. It's in the middle of the woods in a valley. The Appalachian Trail is nearby. They're focused on, you know, eating healthy food and being in nature. And I didn't go because I'm, you know, familiar with Cayce. I went because of Course in Miracles, because my workshop was about the Course. But there's a connection there, as we'll read, because Edgar Cayce's son, Hugh Lynn, had a connection with Helen and Bill. I'll also say before we start that one of my friends that I made when I was teaching the first summer at the ARE, his name is Hal. He wrote a response to this commentary, And I'm going to put it up on my blog finally. So that will be coming out soon. He just basically is drawing out some points that the Cameo is making and is adding to them. So you can keep an eye out for that. All right, so let's dive in. Cameo 15, Edgar Cayce. And by the way, I do want to try to complete this entire Cameo tonight. We'll see. Hopefully that will happen. So I might have some longer stretches of reading, but there's some good nuggets of wisdom in here. In the middle of what is now chapter 3 of the text, Helen received a lengthy commentary on Edgar Cayce, the renowned American psychic. In the summer before the dictation of the course began, sparked by Helen's unusual experiences, Bill read a book about Cayce, which he then got Helen to read, despite her resistance. Once the summer was over, the two of them journeyed to the headquarters of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, the ARE, the organization started by Cayce in Virginia Beach, Virginia. There, Helen and Bill formed a lasting connection with Cayce's son, Hugh Lynn, who from that point on remained supportive of them. The purpose of the following material, which was dictated directly into the text without first being written in Helen's shorthand notebooks, is unclear. It seems mainly designed to distinguish the course's teachings from what Jesus labels as errors in the Cayce material. In the process, it illustrates where a channel, which of course Helen was as well, can go wrong, namely through personal errors influencing the material that comes through. So Jesus says, Bill recently observed how many ideas were condensed into relatively few pages here. This is because we have not been forced to dispel miscreations throughout. There's one set of notes not yet transcribed, which is devoted to this. These emphasize only the enormous waste of time that is involved. Cayce's notes, too, could have been much shortened. Their excessive length is due to two factors. The first involves a fundamental error which Cayce himself made and which required constant undoing. The second is more related to the attitude of his followers. They are unwilling to omit anything he said. This is respectful enough, but not overly judicious. I would be a far better editor if they would allow me this position on their staff. Jesus begins by saying that Helen's most recent notes are more condensed because they are free of the need to dispel miscreations throughout, which is the purpose of the notes we examine in the previous cameo, cameo 14. He then says Edgar Cayce's readings too could have been much shortened. They are too long because a fundamental error of Cayce's kept inserting itself and would then have to be undone, something that would obviously lead to overly long discourses. Cayce's followers should have corrected this through fearless editing, but they did not. And Jesus now seems to explore the fundamental error in more detail. We'll do that in just a moment. I want to just highlight that I think it's so awesome that Jesus says I would be a far better editor if they would allow me this position on their staff. I feel like that's, again, just such a reminder that we can invite, whether you're comfortable with Jesus or Holy Spirit, we can invite Jesus, Holy Spirit in to take the role of something that that needs to be done in any type of circumstance. I will just mention in reading the article that I'll put on my blog, which my friend Hal wrote, he said that Cayce's followers did not omit anything that he said during his trance-like state because Cayce at one point, I guess, was being investigated for these psychic, you know, experiences that he was having and these readings that he was given. So his followers were literally writing down absolutely every word. So that was the explanation that Hal gave. So I just wanted to highlight that piece about Jesus being the far better editor. It's just like using the hire shopping service where he talks about that in I think we probably read it in another cameo already with Helen shopping for a coat. So let's pick up. Jesus now seems to explore the fundamental error in more detail. So I'm like mid page 1779. It is obvious that Casey himself was not able to transcend the misperceptions of the need for sacrifice, or he could not possibly have been willing to sacrifice himself. Anyone who is unable to leave the requests of others unanswered has not entirely transcended egocentricity. I never gave of myself in this inappropriate way, nor would I ever have encouraged Casey to do so. Casey could not see the atonement as totally lacking in sacrifice at any level. It was obvious to him that the mind cannot be so limited by sacrifice. It was equally apparent to him that the soul is merely unaffected by such an idea. This left him only the body with which to invest his misperception of the need for sacrifice. This is also why he used his own mind at the quote-unquote expense of his body. So the commentary continues. These paragraphs refer especially to the latter part of Casey's life during the height of World War II, in which he was deluged with requests for readings, often arriving at a rate of 1,500 per day. Can you imagine? As a result, he gave several times the number of readings per day that his trance source had said was safe for him. His health disintegrated, and he died at the relatively young age of 67. Jesus is particularly concerned with this and has commented on it before saying that Casey should have asked each time whether I wanted him to perform this particular miracle. Because he didn't ask, he burned himself out with indiscriminate miracles, and to this extent did not fulfill his own purpose, an apparent reference to his early death. In the present dictation, Jesus chalks this up to Casey's belief in the need for sacrifice. Knowing that neither the mind nor the soul could sacrifice, Casey placed the burden on his body, using his mind at the expense of the body, of his body. So I'm just going to pause here for a moment again. And I just want to add that one thing that Hal says in the article that he had written was that sacrifice, Casey was Christian, and sacrifice, the idea of sacrifice in its traditional sense, Casey very much embodied and embraced, which is why he did push himself too far. And it's just worth noting that Jesus says, each time that we need to ask each time whether he wants us to perform a particular miracle. And elsewhere, Helen says something to the effect of, if you want me to do it, I will. And if you don't want me to, I won't. So this is just, again, the importance of listening and doing as directed. And Casey burnt himself out by just doing too many readings. And I cannot imagine doing 1,500 of anything in one day. Any comments or questions so far before I continue? All right. Let's keep going. Because Casey was a somewhat erratic listener, he was compelled to correct his own errors at very great length and not always adequately. I'm going to read that one more time. Because Casey was a somewhat erratic listener, he was compelled to correct his own errors at very great length and not always adequately. Consider the basis from which he started when he began with, "Yes, we have the body." It is noteworthy that in all these readings, a large section was actually devoted to the body, even though he usually concluded with the caution that the body cannot be healed by itself. It would have saved an enormous number of words if he had always begun with this. Jesus here gives an example of what caused Casey's readings to be so long. When he began his health readings, he would first psychically locate the body and say, "Yes, we have the body," then diagnose the body's problems and give suggested remedies. Finally, he would often conclude with the caution that the body cannot be healed by itself. Jesus is saying that the heavy focus on the body was an error and that the later caution was a correction of that error. The dictation continues. Casey and his devotion to me are in no way underestimated by the realization that he worked under very great strain, which is always a sign that something is wrong. One of the difficulties inherent in trance states is that it is very difficult to overcome the split which the trance itself induces through the medium of communications made while in the trance state. Casey's whole approach put him in a real double bind from which he did not recover. And the commentary says, the picture here is one of Casey being split. His conscious self was deeply devoted to Jesus, yet also had the normal human needs, which made his life of service a real strain. In Casey's trance state, however, only that selfless devotion was present. Yet, the very act of entering the trance state induced a split between his selfless trance personality and his very human conscious self. Although, we have seen, some of his conscious beliefs and attitudes were apparently able to cross this divide and color his trance communications. Of course, the ideal would then be to resolve this split by following the teachings which came out of the trance state, so that the conscious self would become just as pure as the trance self. What Jesus is saying, however, is that this is very difficult. The divide between the two personalities is so complete, with the trance self being inaccessible to the conscious self, that it's unlikely that the split can be overcome this way. And in this case, Jesus says it never was. And I'll just, before we keep reading the dictation, I'll just mention that one thing that stands out to me in this section is how it says that Casey, first of all, that his devotion to Jesus is in no way underestimated, but that Casey worked under very great strain, and great strain is always a sign that something is wrong. So that's important, I think, for all of us to keep in mind in our daily lives. And for me also, is that when we're feeling that strain, something has gone amiss. I love the course quote that says, discomfort is aroused only to bring the need for correction into awareness. So when we're feeling that strain, when we're feeling that discomfort, that's like a little red flag popping up that it's time to choose again. I'll keep going. Any comments or questions real quick?
I just have one question.
Hi, Paula. Yes.
Hi. This last sentence, the divide between the two personalities is so complete, with the trance self being inaccessible to the conscious self. Does that mean that Casey, when he came out of the trance, couldn't either recall or?
I don't know. I'm not sure. That's a great question. I don't know much about him, so I couldn't say that for sure, but it does just make it sound like there's just, yeah, like a complete divide between those personalities and how that showed up. I mean, the interesting thing is that whatever came out during the trance state was being transcribed, I guess, and written down. So he would still be able to go back and, read that and access it. But I think that, from what we'll read as we keep going, he seemed just like Helen had a really hard time applying doing the course for herself. She's like, what was her famous, she said something like, I just don't believe it. Like I know it's real, but I don't believe it. She said something like that.
Yep.
As we'll read with him, it sounds like he couldn't apply some of the teachings to himself.
That makes sense, really, because I mean, I'll read this book and 5 minutes later, I'm
right.
not applying it. So yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We all do that. Thank you. Paula.
Rin?
Yes.
Rin, as I understand, Casey, when he was in a trance, he had really no idea what he was saying. And that's why Gladys would take diligent transcriptions. There was one case, I think he was in New York visiting someone and they were at a restaurant and he ordered something like, say, burger and fries. And the person said, your teachings just don't exactly be a burger and fries recommendation. And And that wasn't necessarily the suggestion, but you kind of get the gist. Mm-hmm. And it's because he says, you know, I really don't know what I said. That was totally unavailable to him except for reading it through Gladys's translations.
Wow.
So it's not like he was making a conscious decision to not follow his stuff. Mm-hmm. I guess he could have read all the transcriptions and had a better idea what was going on. But yeah, he would come out of trance and not really even know what he said. And he wasn't really the one speaking. I mean, it was, right. I think, Akashic Records, and he was pulling up some kind, he called it the source. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a real unique way of, I like Helen's way a little bit better than his way.
Right, right. That's so helpful, Faden. Thank you so much for adding that. If anything else pops up just from your knowledge, please feel free to share.
Yeah. Yeah. I came to A Course in Miracles through ARE. So
okay, okay.
All awesome. My ARE friends were Course in Miracles people, so that's...
That's cool. That's awesome. That's awesome. Thank you, Faden. Andrea. Andrea, then Nikki.
Yeah, as we were reading that part, what came to mind to me, I don't know, because I've never done any kind of hallucinogenic kind of plant medicine or anything like that, but I wonder if it's something similar about you hear people have some really profound spiritual experiences when they're on some of those kinds of substances. Mm. And but then when they're not on it, they don't have access to it anymore. They remember they had a profound experience, but not the content of it.
Right.
So I wonder if the split that Jesus is talking about is something similar. It's a, you know, being in that trance state is perhaps a little bit like having one of those kinds of spiritual experiences, but then not being able to bridge the divide between the two different states.
That could be, that could very well be. Thank you for that. That's a good concrete example just to try to conceptualize that. Thank you for that. Nikki.
Hi, Corinne. So first off, I'm really eager to see how this ends for Edgar Cayce because
he dies. just kidding. Sorry. My sixth sense of humor.
This happens to me when I do my active Reiki. Oh. So something speaks through me. It's my voice. It uses my voice, but it can do different words and accents and things. And it knows things about people. Like, so I could tap in, I'll be like, oh, you bit somebody when you were 5. And like, how you know that? I'm like, I don't know how I know that. But what happens is over time, because it's only been developing for a few years, is more and more I go away. And I think it's the more that the personality trusts it, I think that's the more than that it can speak through me. So I don't know if it's split. I think that the personality that we have that is split maybe doesn't trust to fully let go, but like in sessions where I've been with people for a while and I can really get out of the way, then it says a lot of things. And then afterwards, it's like, it's almost like a window. So then after a session, I can still kind of tap in or hear or know, but then if it closes like a week later, people will be like, oh, that thing you said in session. I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So I don't know if that clarifies any, but.
Well, it helps. It helps. And it speaks to how I think probably different people are going to have slightly different experiences of that, but it makes absolute sense about the more that you get out of the way, the more that guidance, that intuition, that knowing can come through our spirit.
But now I'm like concerned. I'm like, well, I don't feel exhausted. I don't feel bad from it. I hope I'm not using up all my something and then I'll die.
Again, he was at 1500 a day, like daily, and for like a long, you know, I'm guessing for a long time. And it's just, again, you're going to be checking in. And I think you already do this because, you know, you've shared before just about being connected to yourself and, you know, it's self-care, it's tuning in, it's following that guidance for your own mind and body. And so as long as, you know, you're doing that and following that and honoring that, then, you know, you're going to be used in yeah. Thank you, Nikki. Let's keep reading. Okay. So we're middle of the page 1781. When he spoke of a dream in which he saw his own rather imminent reincarnation, he was perfectly accurate. The footnote says in 1936, Cayce had a dream that he had been born again in the year 2100 AD in Nebraska. He was sufficiently attuned to real communication to make it easy to correct his errors and free him to communicate without strain. It is noticeable throughout his notes that he frequently engaged in a fallacy that we have already noted in some detail, namely, the tendency to endow the physical with non-physical properties. Casey suffered greatly from this error. He did not make either of the other three. However, you'll remember that it is this one which is particularly vulnerable to magical associations. Casey's accuracy was so great that even when he did this, he was able to apply it constructively. But it does not follow that this was a genuinely constructive approach. These lines stress Casey's accuracy as a psychic, though they say that his attunement was contaminated by the second of the four possession fallacies. This is from chapter two in the text, the desire to possess things, and in particular, the tendency to invest the physical with non-physical properties. This is essentially magic, is what it says in the text. The implication is that it was Casey's own investment of physical things with power and significance that led his readings to wrongly emphasize the healing power of physical remedies and objects. The dictation continues. It should also be noted that when Casey attempted to, quote unquote, see the body in proper perspective, he saw physically discernible auras surrounding it. This is a curious compromise in which the non-physical attributes of self are approached as if they could be seen with the physical eye. The commentary continues, Casey's perception of auras, seeing characteristics of the mind appearing as physically visible colors around the body, is another example of his tendency to mix the physical and non-physical. The course does not encourage the seeing of auras. Rather, it is ideal for us to see in others the light of holiness, which is the mind's true characteristic, as opposed to the more superficial characteristic reflected in auras. And it wants us to see this not as a visual light, but as an inner knowing. So I want to just pause here for a quick moment before we continue, just to say that I know it says what it says right here about auras, but I've also known some people and some pretty compelling examples and stories of people who could tap into energy fields. And my mom said that she used to be able to see auras very strongly, and I believe her. So I don't know, you know, ultimately, I completely get that the course, you know, is telling us that everything that we're seeing out there in the world is part of our dream state. It's coming from our sleeping mind. And so the body's physical eyes can't tune into the level of the mind. And yet, like I just said, there's some pretty compelling examples, I think, and experiences that I've heard that speak to something different. So how do you, I don't know that those two things, you know, are sort of reconcilable, but I just wanted to throw that out there for anybody who, you know, has had experiences like that surrounding auras. I think the key piece, no matter what the body's eyes see, is to just recognize that we're always like sensing something from the level of the mind. Do I hear somebody who wanted to say something? Oh, Deidre. Hi, Deidre.
Hi, Corinne. Hi, everyone. I was just going to say around auras, like so many other things with the course, I think it also boils down to like the intention behind it and what is it being used for. Mm-hmm. So Holy Spirit might communicate something one way, or it might show up for someone one way, but what is it being used for?
Yeah. Deidre, I'm so glad you added that. That's it. That is it. What is it being used for? And recognizing that we're going to be used in different ways. And that might mean seeing auras or whatever else it could be. But yes, what is it for? That's awesome. Thank you, Deidre. That was super helpful. Okay, next little blurb here. Casey's illiteracy never stood in his way. This is because illiteracy does not necessarily imply any lack of love. And in Casey's case, very definitely did not. He therefore had no difficulty at all in overcoming this seeming limitation. Now, our commentary says Casey was actually not illiterate, so the information here, for whatever reason, is incorrect. The common idea that he was illiterate was likely sparked by the October 9th, 1910 New York Times article that launched his fame, "Illiterate Man Becomes a Doctor When Hypnotized." Helen may perhaps have heard this, and this may have affected her hearing of Jesus's words. At any rate, the accuracy of her hearing is an issue that arises repeatedly in these early chapters. Although Casey did not have much formal schooling after elementary school, he read widely, including reading the Bible all the way through once a year, a plan he started when he was quite young and maintained for the rest of his life. The dictation continues. What did hamper him was a profound sense of personal unworthiness, which, characteristically enough, was sometimes overcompensated for in what might be called a Christian form of grandiosity. Casey was essentially uncharitable to himself. This made him very erratic in his own miracles, and because he was genuinely anxious to help others, left himself in a highly vulnerable position. The commentary says Casey's real problem, which will be expanded upon below, was a profound sense of personal unworthiness, which he compensated for with a Christian form of grandiosity. Based on earlier references to Christians, this probably means that he saw himself as heroically suffering and sacrificing on behalf of others, and that he viewed such sacrifice as the way to shore up his unworthiness. It's not hard to see how combining this with being genuinely anxious to help others would leave him in a highly vulnerable position. I'll just pause here for a moment and just mention for Nikki that this is just key, where it says that he had this profound sense of personal unworthiness and was essentially uncharitable to himself. This is a lesson, you know, for all of us with seeking out and finding and handing over any sense of personal unworthiness that we might have within ourselves, any way in which we are uncharitable to ourselves, and handing that to the Holy Spirit, because in those instances where there is that unworthiness or that is that, you know, uncharitable stance toward oneself, that can put us then in positions where, like it says, we become highly vulnerable because we're either sacrificing ourselves or not taking care of ourselves, doing too much, putting ourselves out there in some kind of inappropriate way. So Nikki, I just wanted to highlight that, but I feel like that's an answer, is that it's being charitable to yourself. Awesome. Good. His son, Hugh Lynn, comments both on the rather erratic this is commentary again. I'm in the middle of the page. Not commentary, dictation. His son, Hugh Lynn, comments both on the rather erratic nature of the Casey household and also on the rather uneven nature of Casey's temper. Both of these observations are true and clearly point to the fact that Casey did not apply the peace of God to himself. Once this had occurred, particularly in a man whose communication channels were open, it was virtually impossible for him to escape external solutions. Casey was a very religious man who should have been able to escape fear through religion. Being unable to apply his religion wholeheartedly to himself, he was forced to accept certain magical beliefs which were alien to his own Christianity. This is why he was so different when he was asleep and even disowned what he said in this state. So he did not apply the peace of God to himself. You know, I just want to say this before it escapes my head. In the beginning of this commentary, it says that it's not entirely clear why this is here, this material on Edgar Casey. And yet what we said before about Helen not necessarily being able to apply the course to herself, here Jesus is giving Helen an example of Edgar Casey and how he wasn't able to apply it to himself. So maybe it was there as, you know, a potential learning opportunity for Helen, even though this came very early. But that just connected in my mind. All right, bottom of page 1783. We've already been told that Casey's listening and miracles were erratic. Jesus now tells us that Casey's household was erratic and that his temper was uneven, and that this was due to his belief that he was so unworthy that the peace, this was due to his belief that he was so unworthy that the peace of God promised by his religion did not apply to him. He therefore had to seek external solutions to his lack of peace in the form of various physical substances to which he ascribed magical power, as we will see below. I'll read two more paragraphs and then we'll pause. The lack of integration which this split state implies is clearly shown in certain off-the-mark detours into areas such as the effects of stones on the mind and some curious symbolic attempt to integrate churches and glands. And in parentheses, this is hardly more peculiar than some of your own confusion. Casey's readings taught that gems and stones have healing vibrations. Also, their interpretation of the Book of Revelation likened that book's seven churches to the seven chakras in the body, which were associated with the endocrine glands. Jesus calls both of these off-the-mark detours, apparently because they joined the non-physical, mind or religion, with physical, stones and endocrine glands. I'll pause for a moment. I want to see if anybody has any comments or questions, but this just reminds me of how I've given the course teaching. I've given everything I see, all the meaning it has for me. If we ascribe meaning to something, it's going to have meaning for us. If we feel like that stone has a healing vibration, we're going to feel good when we hold it. It doesn't mean that that's bad to do or anything, but we're ascribing, you know, the meaning. I don't know that there's ever been any scientific studies to see if there's effects on the body for certain stones. My guess is that if there was, they came up with nothing, or we would widely know about that. But that's what comes up for me, is that we've given everything. We see all the meaning it has, but like DJ said before, what is it for? If it's used in a overall healing pathway of continually deepening our level of trust in Holy Spirit and recognizing that healing is from the mind, and it's like a stepping stone, beautiful. Use your crystals, use your stones, let them be helpful. But if we stop there and idolize those things and think that those things are going to save us, that anything out there could save us, then that's when we have to choose again. That's when we're probably going to hit some bumps in the road, because as we know, all healing comes from the mind. Any comments or questions so far? Looks like we're good. And anybody who has your camera off, or I know for those of you on the phone, you don't have access to the chat, but you can always pop something into the chat if you'd like. Okay. Now we're at the middle of page 1784. Casey's mind was imprisoned to some extent by an error against which you have been cautioned several times. He looked to the past for an explanation of the present, but never succeeded in separating the past from the present. When he said, "Mind is the builder," he did not realize that it is only what it is building now that really creates the future. The past in itself does not have the ability to do this. Whenever we move from one instant to the next, the previous one no longer exists. In considering the body as the focus for healing, Casey was expressing his own failure to accept this, the non-existence of the past, as accomplished. He did not fail to recognize the value of the atonement for others, but did fail to accept its corrective merit for himself. As we have frequently emphasized, man cannot control his own errors. Having created them, he does believe in them. Because of his failure to accept his own perfect freedom from the past, Casey could not really perceive others as similarly free. This is why I have not wholly endorsed the Casey documents for widespread use. As part of Casey's, so this is the commentary, as part of Casey's sense of unworthiness, he could not believe that he was free from his past mistakes. He could not, in other words, accept the atonement for himself. This distortion leaked into his readings, where, as a result, he saw the past mistakes of others rather than their present choices as building their future, including the condition of their bodies. He saw their state of health, in other words, as a prisoner of their past misdeeds. This error is such an important one that Jesus says, it is why I have not wholly endorsed the Casey documents for widespread use. And I'll just pause there. I see Andrea wrote, the ACIM teaching that we give all the meaning that anything holds for us by our own belief is the teaching for today or yesterday. Oh, for you started the, so it's the lesson for today. That's so cool. I love it. I love it. I feel like that's another, a little beautiful synchronicity, so that I've given everything I see, all the meaning it has is today's lesson of the year. That's so cool. Thank you for that, Andrea. Okay. Let's continue here with the commentary on the top of page 1785, actually the dictation. I am heartily supportive of the ARE's endeavor to make Casey's singular contributions immortal, but it would be most unwise to have them promulgated as a faith until they have been purged of their essential errors. This is why there have been a number of unexplained setbacks in their explication. It is also one of the many reasons why the Casey material, a major step in the speed up, must be properly understood before it can be meaningfully validated. Casey's son has been wise in attempting to deal with reliability, and there's a footnote that he would go, that Casey, Hewlin Casey, would go on to write with his brother a book about where Casey's readings were inaccurate. So let me just read that sentence again. Casey's son has been wise in attempting to deal with reliability, which in Casey's case is very high. There is a way of validating the material, and Hugh Lynn is perfectly aware that this must be done eventually. He is also aware of the fact that he is unable to do it. In the present state of the material, it would be most unwise even to attempt it. There is too much that is invalid. When the time comes that this can be corrected to the point of real safety, I assure you it will be accomplished. In tribute to Casey, I remind you that no effort is wasted, and Casey's effort was very great. It would be most ungrateful of me if I allowed his work to produce a generation of witch doctors, a reference to Casey's prescribing of various magical remedies. I am sorry that Casey himself could not rid himself of a slight tendency in this direction, but fortunately, I have a fuller appreciation of him than he had. I am repeating here a biblical injunction of my own, already mentioned elsewhere, that if my followers eat any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. This is what Casey could not believe, because he could not see that, as a son of God, he was invulnerable. So before I read the very last few paragraphs of commentary, which kind of explain a little bit more about just what we've read, I'll just highlight a couple of things. And again, if anybody has any comments or questions or insights, please jump in. So it sounds like his son knows that the editing needs to be done, but that he's not the one to do it. I like how it says that Jesus says, I remind you that no effort is wasted. And that's really important for us to remember on our journey, that when we feel like we're just struggling and trying, every little choice that we make for love instead of fear, every act of kindness, every miracle impulse that we allow, that comes up through us, that we allow to be extended outward, no effort is wasted. And that is really, really important to remember. And I also just like the ending part that we just read about, as a son of God, he was invulnerable. Just a good reminder, especially in this day and time of this crazy world that we're in.
Hey, Corinne.
Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to throw a little something in there. I remember in reading Ram Dass's book one time, he talked about how there was this yogi in India and he was taking LSD and whatnot. And the yogi asked him about it and stuff. And he said, well, give me some. And he gave him one. He's like, no, give me a bunch. And he took like 12 or 20 of them or something and ate them all. And I mean, it was really potent back then too. It wasn't like his. Wow. But Ram Dass was like, oh my God, you're going to kill yourself. And he's like, no, nothing can hurt me. And he didn't have, it had no effect on him whatsoever. Just to highlight that one thing.
I'm so glad that you shared that example, because that's the power of the mind. And John, you're reminding me of, has anybody ever heard of, I think like the media has dubbed him the starving yogi. If you Google it, I haven't Googled it in a while, but it's a yogi who supposedly has not eaten or drank any water in years, and he's alive. Wow. and well, and scientists are like, well, he's got to be absorbing water somehow, and they can't wrap their heads around it. And I think the media dubbed him the starving yogi, but there's lots of stories like that of things that we think that people do, that yogis can do with their minds. And it's big about the power of belief. I mean, think about placebo studies too. When people are in studies where there's a, you know, some type of pill medicine that's being tested, even like vaccine trials, and then a placebo, those who think that they're getting medicine can sometimes report side effects that could be associated with the medicine, but they just got a sugar pill. So our minds are super powerful. And I can just, let me just throw this out there just from personal experience. My anxiety history and my past anxiety patterns could be so strong that I could generate all sorts of physical symptoms, like all over the map throughout my body. The moment a doctor told me I would be fine, poof, they could all go away in an instant. So yeah, thank you for that, John. Hi, Dave.
I wanted to share something along that line. In your book or one of your videos or something, you talked about there being, let's see, you were feeling some symptoms and you were instructed to open up the course, and it said guilt will, let's see, the body will remain guilt's messenger, et cetera, et cetera. And so you came up with this phrase, there's no guilt in me, and no guilt in me. And so about a year and a half ago, I dropped something really heavy on my foot, and it was sharp, and it dropped on my instep. I didn't have shoes on, and it started to hurt really bad. And I just used that phrase, there is no guilt in me, and the pain went away. And I went like, that's nah, you know. And so then the pain, you know, came back. So I did it again. There's no guilt in me, and it went away, but I didn't believe it. So it came back again. But anyway, it really does work.
Wow, Dave, that's powerful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And yeah, it's funny when the doubt, you know, comes back in and, you know, visits us, but that course quote, thank you for sharing that. I that was such a very significant moment for me. That course quote that I opened to, because I was having like a belly issue. It said, the body will remain guilt's messenger and act as it directs, as guilt directs, as long as you believe that guilt is real. It doesn't say as long as you believe that the body is real, as long as you believe that guilt is real. So yeah, that's where that phrase came from. There's no guilt in me. There's no guilt in others. And you know, yes.
Another.
Thank you, Dean.
Excellent. One is, I choose the joy of God instead of pain. After my husband passed, there were many nights where I latch on to that. I choose the joy of God instead of pain. And believe me, I would get through the night beautifully. It is, yeah, this stuff works.
It does. It does. Thank you for sharing that, Paula. I want to try, we have a few paragraphs left that we will complete tonight, but I just want to see if I can share a very brief story with you all. And this is a story that I'll be sharing on our Love Lens episode on Tuesday, because healing is also interpersonal. So yes, it's absolutely about working with our thoughts. It's about, you know, working with these lessons, but the interpersonal nature of the course that I feel like I was out of touch with for so long also applies to healing. So really quick, super quick story, and I'll be sharing more about this in the actual episode. In one of the Love Lens episodes, I think it was episode 3, Freedom and I did a role play where I was the white course teacher and she was the black course student. And we did 2 role plays. The first one was basically her asking a question about how what I was teaching applied to race. And in the first role play, my name was Karen, her name was Michelle. We had to do that for some distance. In the first role play, I kind of was like, well, the course is this and the course is that. And I like came on really strong with just like kind of like slapping course quotes down. And when we did the dress rehearsal, so, and then the second role play is basically how to respond appropriately. When we did the dress rehearsal, it was so like Freedom was nearly sick to her stomach. I felt like I was in the role of an abuser. I felt absolutely disgusting. We were both like sick to our stomachs. And Freedom was like, we unleashed some angry white women energy. And we started like shaking it off and trying to get out of the roles, because at that point in our first dress rehearsal, I was Corinne and she was Freedom. So we weren't like acting, you know, we were acting, but with our own names. And long story short, I had an experience of feeling this like rage pass through me. What felt like to me, like how the course says that we carry unconscious guilt and fear. It was as if something came up to the surface. And the next morning I woke up with a sty, which I may have mentioned when we were all together on this call around that time. And it blew up fast. It was like crazy infection that I didn't want to take antibiotics for, but by the second day I was like, give me the antibiotics because this is just like on fire and out of control. Long story short, I ended up with a lump on my eyelid from that infection after only 2 days before I got an antibiotics, because scar tissue formed around it and it wasn't going away. And basically my eye doctor said, if you want it to go away, you have to have it surgically removed. And I was just like, great. So I'm just going to live with it. 6 weeks later, it had been unchanged. Emily in our group went through an incredible transformation, which we'll talk about in this Love Lens episode, because she basically went through a transformation of seeing how a lot of what we were teaching, how it applied to her. And in her recognition and her healing, because it was a very stressful situation between all of us, with her healing and recognizing that this was actually happening, like she had this huge transformation. The next time I looked in the mirror, it was probably the next day, the lump was like 60% gone. And then since then it's like 95% gone. Like I can't even see with my own eyes anymore. I have to like take a selfie and look really close to see if it's there. And it's pretty much almost gone. So I just wanted to say that again too, because it's the interpersonal nature of healing. It's like an interlocking chain of forgiveness. And this is how we are all connected. This is how everyone on the planet is connected, that each time, as it says right here that we just read, no effort is wasted. Every time we release a judgment, every time we release a fear, it affects somebody else, some other, be it person or living thing, it affects that person who is ready to receive that healing. So we are not, it might seem at times that we're just doing this for my body, but you know, each of our bodies, not my body, but we're doing this all together. And so I just felt moved to share that. Cool stuff, right? Let's finish out this cameo. So I'm at the very bottom of page 1785. Jesus now revisits the need for editing that he mentions at the start. As we can see in several places, this editing is not primarily about, I'm sorry. As we can see in several places, this editing is not primarily about removing excessive verbiage, but about excising invalid ideas. Until these errors are edited out of the Casey readings, Jesus says that he does not want them promulgated as a faith. And this is why quote unquote setbacks have been placed in the way of that promulgation. However, due to the importance of the Casey material, he promises that this editing will eventually be accomplished in tribute to Casey. In this discourse, it is clear that Jesus does not want Helen and Bill to uncritically mix the Casey readings with what he is teaching them. Rather, he wants them to be clear on the important distinctions between the two teachings. In his view, the Casey readings are too focused on the body and too mired in the past, and they also inappropriately grant magical power to physical substances. This, he says, was a product of Casey's own sense of unworthiness, in which he felt imprisoned by past sins. His sense of unworthiness caused him to feel cut off from the atonement's liberating power, and as a result, he sought a false atonement through personal sacrifice and magical potions. Yet, this is no rant against Casey. A clear appreciation and respect for Casey comes through in this discourse. Indeed, Jesus wants to make sure that Casey's devotion to him is in no way underestimated by focusing unduly on his criticisms. He praises Casey's accuracy and says his effort was very great. He goes further, calling Casey's contribution a major step in the celestial speedup, which is heaven's drive to reverse humanity's backward motion. He even says, "I am heartily supportive of the ARE's endeavor to make Casey's singular contributions immortal." Even Jesus's analysis of Casey's errors becomes a kind of indirect honoring of Casey. For his errors did not stem from hubris or desire for self-glorification. Rather, his problem was that he did not value himself enough. He was essentially uncharitable to himself. Jesus clearly wishes that Casey had been able to free himself of this, that he had been able to apply the peace of God to himself. It is not a case, therefore, of Casey thinking too highly of himself and Jesus wanting to take him down a few pegs. Instead, it is exactly the opposite. Fortunately, Jesus says, "I have a fuller appreciation of him than he had." And that concludes Cameo 15. Some good nuggets in here, right? Before we go, any final comments or questions?
I have one question, kind of. I was watching a show on Netflix about the afterlife and near-death experiences and different things, but it also talked about mediums. And that's kind of what Casey was a medium in a sense, right? And it talked about the physical attributes sometimes that they took on, and like ectoplasm coming out of them, and that it would burn and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, this is really weird. And I kind of stopped watching that section of it and went on to the next one. But I thought, okay, that, you know, because I'm thinking, why would God give us these abilities and then have them be painful to us? Mm-hmm. You know, the same as with Casey. I guess maybe it's that mentality of suffering that we need to suffer.
I think that's definitely part of it. And again, we all have our own ego hooks. And so wherever it is that we are, you know, hooked, that can get in the way of those gifts that we, you know, are given right, to be used. So perhaps.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, John. Dave, did you want to add something or no? No, you're good.
No.
Okay. Gotcha. Wonderful. I just see in the chat, Nikki said, in my meditation classes, I used to have people focus on their right hand, tell it loves it, think and feel about love, et cetera, then focus on the left hand and say, I hate you. You can actually feel the difference in each hand. Oh, so you're actually talking to each hand, like, I love you, I hate you. You can definitely feel that. And, you know, what's the name of the, oh, I can't think of his name. There's some guy, I believe it's a Japanese, I don't know if he's a doctor or what, he did studies of having vials of water at the point of freezing. And either like somebody said, I love you. This was in What the Bleep Do We Know. I think it was in there. And then I've seen other things about it versus like, I hate you, saying it to the water at the point of freezing. And the, I love you water turned into like beautiful crystallized, like snowflake looking designs. And the, I hate you water as at the point of freezing was like, you know, not like a pretty snowflake. It was like, you know, asymmetrical. And so that's interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Nikki. Anyway, thank you, everyone. Been fun and so great to join with you as always. We will be here again next week to read the next cameo called Helen's Extra Mile. So have a beautiful and blessed week, and I love you all. I'll see you in a week. Good night,
thank
everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. Bye, everybody. Thank you. Love you all. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. I don't know how to stop recording.